I am delighted that we're able to have with us today Dr. Norman Baylor from the Food and Drug Administration. Dr. Baylor is the director of the Office of Vaccines Research and Review and FDA Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research. And it's a real privilege for us to have him here with us at the National Immunization Conference to talk to us this afternoon about a topic that perhaps comes up sometimes in the course of immunization delivery, which is vaccine ingredients. Thanks.
Thank you, Melinda. And it's good to be here. I'm going to try to, some of you may be familiar with how the FDA works and how we regulate vaccines, and I'm going to try to walk you through that and talk about vaccine ingredients along the way. All right, I just changed my first slide, so I didn't know that. Let's start out with the organization of the FDA, because many of you probably are not aware of that. The FDA, let's see, I think I went back too far. The FDA is organized into seven centers: Center for Biologics, Center for Devices, Center for Veterinary Medicine, the Center for Drugs, and the Center for Food Safety, as well as we have an Office of Regulatory Affairs, that's our Office of Enforcement, and the National Center for Toxicological Research in Arkansas. The organization that's responsible for regulating vaccines in the United States, at least prophylactic vaccines and other related products, is the Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research. And within the Center for Biologics and Research, it's the Office of Vaccines Research and Review, that's my office, as well as the Office of Compliance and the Office of Biostatistics and Epidemiology, who are responsible for regulating vaccines in the United States. I should back up a minute and say that as many folks don't realize that the Food and Drug Administration is part of the public health service. And so, and as such, we are also responsible, and part of our mission is to facilitate the availability of safe and effective vaccines. So it's not just, we just don't sit in an office, we review, and it's either yes or no. Our goal and our mission is to make sure that we have supplies of safe and effective vaccines available to the country. Now, licensed vaccines, they need to be safe. They need to be pure, and they need to be potent. That's the bottom line. But safety, even as it says in our regulations, is relative. There's nothing that's 100% safe. So they should be relatively free of harmful effect. They should be pure, and that's, again, relatively free from extraneous matter. And potent, they should work. And it's quite important that the manufacturing is consistent and according to good manufacturing practices. I've seen many vaccines have really wonderful clinical trials, but the manufacturer could not demonstrate consistency of manufacture, and that product was not licensed. So manufacturing is critical for licensure for safe and effective products. How does the FDA evaluate vaccines to make sure they're safe? Well, before a vaccine is licensed, these vaccines are tested extensively for safety in the laboratory. So once there's a proof of concept, the safety as well as the effectiveness is tested in the laboratory. They're tested in animals. This is our preclinical studies. And then successive stages in human trials from phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3. And prior to going into humans, these phases in humans are what we call the IND process, or an investigation of a new drug application. So these vaccines are studied under the IND, and this is regulated by the FDA, and we give the no or go as to whether those clinical trials will go forward. And again, it's critical to have at every stage of the development of manufacturing data to demonstrate that the product is manufactured consistently and in a safe manner. And if all the data at any stage of the development, whether that data is clinical or whether that data is manufacturing data, we will stop the trial until those issues are resolved before going forward with those studies. Let's look a little closer at vaccine manufacturing and characterization. The vaccine development and characterization, it's partly codified in our regulations, in 21 CFR, the Code of Federal Regulations. And there are regulations in there about sterility. If the product should be sterile, then it has to adhere to the regulations. The general safety test, this is a guinea pig test that demonstrates that the product is free of extraneous toxic contaminants. Of course, the product should be pure. There shouldn't be any pyrogens in the product. If the product is lyophilized, it should be, they should test the moisture content. And then identity is also identified in our regulations. And identity is nothing more than what you say you put in the vial is in the vial. So you need a test to make sure that for that final container, it is what you say it is. And then there are a variety of other release tests, some of which are codified in the regulations, some of which are not. And this is a good thing because some of the tests, to keep up with the state of the art, we don't codify all of the tests. And then as we work our way toward vaccine ingredients, the regulation 21 CFR 610, it outlines constituent materials. And constituent materials, these are ingredients in the vaccine, such as preservatives, diluents, or adjuvants. And all of the ingredients in vaccines, in licensed vaccines, as well as the diluent, these should meet a generally accepted standards of purity and quality. As far as preservative, the preservative should be sufficiently non-toxic so that the amount that's present in the recommended dose of the product will not be toxic to the recipient. The regulations continues with a definition of an adjuvant, and this adjuvant shall not be introduced into the product unless there's satisfactory evidence that adjuvant does not adversely affect the safety or potency of the product. And as we go further in the regulations to actually codify the amount of aluminum that's recommended in an individual dose, and if some of you who heard Paul Offit's talk this morning about aluminum, in the regulations it's codified as to what the amount of aluminum that's allowed per dose, and it's 0.85 milligrams if determined by assay, and 1.14 milligram if determined by calculation on the basis of adding the aluminum to the product. This is a very old regulation, and this regulation was based on experimental data going back many years. And it's interesting that today, aluminum is the only adjuvant used in U.S. licensed vaccines. So if there are other adjuvants used or used in licensed products in the future, we probably will not codify that in the regulations because, this allows the state of the art to move forward. I'll also get a little bit more, as I go further in the talk, get a little bit more into the adjuvants and preservatives. I want to emphasize the production and quality control. Again, this slide, I just wanted to demonstrate that the detailed manufacturing is required. When manufacturers submit their applications for review by the FDA, they have to include detailed manufacturing. The components in the product must be compatible. They must be defined. The product must be characterized. If you're using a cell substrate for propagation of the viral product, the cell substrate must be defined, well characterized, free of adventitious agents. The manufacturers are also required to make sure they have a consistency of production. If you're going from a proof of concept, a laboratory scale, you may be able to make 100 doses consistently, but once that product is licensed, you have to demonstrate that you can make millions and millions of doses of that product consistently every time. We also look at in-process tests for the product as far as the quality, the yields, the inactivation process, if it's a live product, as well as the sources of material, whether we're talking about bovine-derived products or whatever. We look at the source, we look at the batch records, and we review these to make sure these are of high quality. Again, purification information is important in the applications. Documenting that the product is free of extraneous materials. The product needs to be stable because, again, the product will have a shelf life. We really don't make vaccines every day, sort of like organic vaccines. We have to be able to store vaccines, and so they have to be stable. And also, it's important for the manufacturers to have the facilities and the manufacturing equipment qualified, validated, and the FDA will actually go on inspection and look at the facility to make sure the facility is meeting good manufacturing practices. We also require non-clinical studies, and non-clinical studies for product characterization. It's also used for attenuation if they're live organisms. But importantly also is to make sure that the product is not toxic. So non-clinical studies are used to look at the toxicity of the product. And I should emphasize here, we don't look at the product, we don't chop the product up and look at the adjuvant and look at the preservative. We look at the product as one entity. And so when that product is manufactured, we're looking at it as one entity. When that product is studied in a clinical trial, we're not studying the adjuvant in the clinical trial. We're studying that product as the safety and effectiveness of that product as it is manufactured as one entity. Now, let's get a little bit into the vaccine ingredients and excipients. The key component of the vaccine, of course, is the antigen, and that's the immunogen. And that's the component of the vaccine that elicits an immune response, and this is typically a weakened live organism, or it may be a fragmented portion, such as a subunit, or it could be a peptide. It's a compound or a component that elicits an immune response. Then some products have adjuvants in them, and I mentioned that earlier, such as aluminum, and this helps promote stronger immune response to the antigen. The aluminum salts, as I mentioned. There are other adjuvants such as MF59, water and oil emulsions. Not all vaccines require an adjuvant, but many do require an adjuvant, and adjuvants have shown us recently that they can enhance even more so the immune response of a quite effective vaccine, even more effective. And then there are preservatives, and these are compounds that kill or prevent the growth of microorganisms, particularly bacteria and fungi. And they're used in vaccines to prevent microbial growth in the event that the vaccine is accidentally contaminated. And this might occur as you go into that vial repeatedly. In some cases, preservatives are added during the manufacturing process. The manufacturing process is extremely complicated, and it's just hundreds and hundreds of steps involved in manufacturing a vaccine. And there, as you have hundreds and hundreds of steps, you have hundreds and hundreds of places where you can contaminate the process. And so sometimes preservatives are used along in the process to prevent microbial growth. In the regulations, I didn't show this part in the regulations, but preservatives are required for multi-dose vials. Preservatives are not required for single-dose vials. So it is possible to manufacture a vaccine that if it's going to be a single dose without a preservative. But because of the regulations and because of the potential for the contamination in the multi-dose vials, we do require that those vaccines have preservatives. But keeping with the technology, there is information that multi-dose vials may be able to be produced in the future without a preservative. And so we don't we don't stifle the technology. So if that technology comes across that they can demonstrate that multi-dose vial of vaccine is intact and not able to be contaminated, then we would move forward with the necessary steps to approve something like that. Now I want to go a little further on the preservatives. And preservatives, what we follow is the USP, the United States Pharmacopeia, the antimicrobial preservative effectiveness test. So when a preservative is used or a manufacturer recommends that a particular preservative is going to be used, they have to demonstrate the effectiveness of that compound when used as a preservative or additive to prevent pathogenic organisms. And so the preservative effectiveness test outline says that there are three pathogenic bacteria, Staph aureus, Pseudomonas aeruginosa, and E. coli, and fungi, Aspergillus niger, and Candida albicans. So the test should demonstrate that the preservative is able to prevent the growth of these organisms, and this data is submitted by the manufacturer and reviewed by the FDA before we will approve that this particular compound does meet the preservative effectiveness test. As you're all aware of Thimerosal, and you're all aware of all the history most of the history and what we've gone through with Thimerosal. Thimerosal is an extremely good preservative, and it was used as a preservative in some vaccines since the 1930s. About 50% by weight of Thimerosal is mercury, and it's degraded into ethyl mercury or thiosalicylate. And the concentrations found in vaccine, they all meet the USP preservative effectiveness test. But Thimerosal is no longer used and routinely recommended pediatric vaccines with the exception of some influenza vaccines. And many of the, there are Thimerosal-free influenza vaccines, but not enough, not sufficient doses have been produced yet. But it is possible to manufacture those without this preservative. But it's a highly it's been a highly effective preservative. And again, the concentrations in the vaccines were extremely low. They're used in such as 0.003% to 0.01%, and the 0.01% equates to about 25 micrograms of mercury per half mil dose. So extremely low amounts. Let's move to excipients. Vaccine excipients. These are inert substances other than the active ingredient or the immunogen or antigen found in the finalized vaccine product. These are such things as buffers, stabilizers, diluents, surfactants, we also have, let me move further and give you an example of a vaccine content in a couple of vaccines. You probably can guess what vaccines these are, but I didn't name them because I didn't want to advertise any. So if looking at this, I mean, here are the active ingredients in this combination vaccine here, and we see it. The immunogen is diphtheria, tetanus, and tetanus toxoids. There's inactivated pertussis toxoid in there. There's filamentous hemagglutinin and protactin. These are all components of the pertussis antigen. And then there's hepatitis B and the polio virus. And these are all the active ingredients. And then if we look at the adjuvant and other excipients, the adjuvant in this particular vaccine is aluminum. It's 0.85 micrograms. Milligrams, I'm sorry, and it's this is the adjuvant, and this is per dose, and this meets the regulation. And then the other excipients are like sodium chloride, there's residual formaldehyde, and many of you have there's been some outcry about formaldehyde. Again, these are used in very small amounts, and we have to think about why are we using these compounds for. As you saw, this vaccine is it has polio in it, and it's an IPV. It's an inactivated polio. You just can't inactivate the polio with some inert substance such as water. you have to use something. So you know this compound is, it has some activity. It must, in order to make this vaccine safe. Many of you may be aware of the Qatar incident, which children were infected with polio from the vaccine because the vaccine was not inactivated properly. So you do need compounds that will inactivate these live organisms. So it's critical. But in the manufacturing, you're going to use very small amounts, just enough. And this is a part of validation. You're going to validate the inactivation process so that you'll determine the minimum amount of this compound needed to inactivate the virus. I mean, the improperly inactivated polio virus is much more harmful than this small amount of formaldehyde. And then you have such things in the vaccine, such as polysorbate 80, and this again, this is this compound is a surfactant. And for folks who are thinking that this is a really dangerous compound, actually it's used in ice cream manufacturing also, and it allows the ice cream as it melts to retain its shape. So this is not a strange compound. It may just sound strange. And then there's neomycin sulfate and other antimicrobials in there because again, you don't want the product to be contaminated. And you may remember that there was hepatitis B in this product, and so there's going to be some residual yeast in the product because the product was the hepatitis B was grown in on yeast. Another example of this product, the similar immunogens or antigens. This product has Haemophilus influenza, unlike the other product. And again, this product also has aluminum adjuvant in it. It has formaldehyde as well as glutaraldehyde as far as the inactivation and the detoxifying agent. Again, the toxins, these are very dangerous compounds in these organisms. So you want to make sure that you detoxify or toxoid the toxin so that the toxin won't cause harm. And again, so it's very important to make sure that these compounds are used in minimal amounts. And as you can see here, these are very small amounts, 50 nanograms of glutaraldehyde and less than or equal to five micrograms of formaldehyde. 2-phenoxyethanol, this is actually it has been used as a surfactant, but when there's formaldehyde in a product along with 2-phenoxyethanol, it can also serve as a preservative. And then there's polysorbate 80 in this product as well, and some antimicrobial agents. So in summary, licensed vaccines undergo rigorous safety testing before they're released. And unlike many products, vaccines are lot released. That means that every lot is either submitted to the FDA before it's released to the public, or all of the specifications which we agree upon with the company and what we call a lot release protocol. And that protocol outlines the tests that were done to demonstrate that that product was manufactured consistently and safe. And we review those, and we may do testing on our own because the Office of Vaccines has many offices in CBER. We have laboratories that do research as well as QC testing. And so we're able to review and test if we feel needed every lot. And we have that authority before we release those products. Also, vaccines, because the manufacturing process is so complex and so detailed, it does require a more stringent regulatory oversight. And again, we also have the ability of doing inspections in the manufacturing sites. The tests in the vaccine production process, these are done to ensure that the vaccines are free from contamination and also screen for other infections of humans. So in other words, even the sources, as I mentioned before, the sources of the components and other raw materials for vaccines, we're looking at those batch records as well. There's a high demand for safety, and that emphasizes the importance of a well-characterized manufacturing process that produces a product time after time after time again that's consistently safe and effective. And we don't, at the FDA, when we license the product, we don't turn our backs on the product at that time. Actually, we turn forward because that's the process really starts. And we continuously monitor the safety and effectiveness of the product and all vaccines once they're licensed. And for as long as that product is licensed, we monitor that product and the manufacturing. Here's some available resources, our website, phone number, some other references on ICH, and the regulation and testing of vaccines. We have a chapter in the vaccines book. If you really want more details, I think that would be a good resource to go to. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Norman. That was a great overview. We do have a few minutes and can take some questions from the audience. While we're waiting for people to come up with a microphone, I will ask one for John. John, you mentioned some of the rapid cycle analysis work that's been done by the Vaccine Safety Data Link. And this is a new method that the VSD has developed over the last few years. Could you just tell folks a little bit about that so they'll know what that is when they hear about it?
Sure. So anytime there is a new vaccine recommendation or an expansion of an existing recommendation, VSD undertakes near real-time weekly surveillance looking at pre-specified outcomes that are defined based on information from VAERS and information from the pre-licensure testing and what's known about the biological properties of the vaccine. And this allows for real-world post-licensure data that's available in a more timely manner than traditional epidemiologic studies. But these maintain the very high, rigorous data quality and statistical standards of the VSD. And so the I highlighted both MMRV and HPV rapid cycle studies.
So thanks, John. Question over here first.
Yes, for Dr. Baylor. This morning we heard Paul Offit describe the amount of thimerosal mercury in vaccines in 1980 versus 2007 or 8, and how today it's in 100 to 150 milligram range, I guess. But when the FDA made that decision or that calculation, saying above this rate of thimerosal in vaccines was unsafe, so we exceeded the amount, the daily amount that infants could have. I understand that was based on not the ethyl marker, but the what's the other marker?
Was the methyl mercury guidelines?
Yes.
Right.
I don't understand that relationship, and I don't know if you'd like to comment on what that correlation is. But my real question is, given what Dr. Offit said this morning, how the body excretes it, is absorbed, is excreted in a certain short period of time, do you think the FDA will ever change that recommendation based on those kind of statements? Are we always going to be? I'm very concerned with the banned thimerosal in vaccines. I think if we had a pandemic flu epidemic in this country today, and the only vaccine that we had was an absorbent amount of thimerosal and mercury, I think we'd all be rushing to get it. And I know that sounds sarcastic, but I'm very concerned about the anti-vaccine movement in this country. We're losing, our rates are going down. More parents are objecting to vaccines. And one of the things that they're using against us There are all the elements that you show, the ingredients that you show in vaccines, and I'm afraid that they will continue to pick off the formaldehydes and the aluminum and just one right after the other if this process keeps going. So do you think we'll always be with that standard for ethyl mercury?
Well, let me just clarify. The FDA has never banned thimerosal from vaccines. We, as I showed in my slide, there is still thimerosal in influenza vaccines and some influenza vaccines. What we said, what the FDA and other parts of the Public Health Service agency said, was that we believe that these vaccines can be made without thimerosal. And we all recognize, I mean, I think we would all say that if we can remove mercury from vaccines or other products, and we have the ability to do that, and the manufacturers demonstrated that they could do that, then we did it, and it was done. But we also have to look at benefit risk. The example you gave of pandemic influenza. If we're in a position where we're, and we, the global we, are in a position where we're facing a pandemic, and we have to deploy large numbers of doses to vaccine throughout this country, we probably will have to put that, vial those in multi-dose vials. And right now, that would require a preservative, and we would and it would probably be done. So, we have to get the message across about benefit risk. I mean, if you look at compounds, all kinds of chemicals are scary because they have weird shapes and weird structures, and they have long names. And we have to communicate we have to do a better job in communicating to people what these compounds are, the amount in these compounds, and the fact that we are talking about benefit risk. It's the example I gave you with the IPV. If IPV was not, if the polio virus was not activated in that vaccine, we would be in big trouble. And we just need to do a better job in communicating that. And the same goes for that you mentioned the thimerosal, but the same goes for the aluminum and other compounds. But I really do think that the technology is going to help us also, because there are some interesting things happening out there as far as being able to make a vaccine without a preservative. And we may be at the early stages of that now, but if that moves quickly, we might be able to have that pandemic vaccine, multi-dose vaccine without a preservative in it.
Thank you.
The licensed H5N1 vaccine does contain thimerosal, doesn't it?
Yes, because it's in a multi-dose vial.
Yeah. Okay, we'll take a question over here.
This question is for Dr. Biller. You said in your presentation that the studies for aluminum are old studies, like they were, because aluminum was put in a long time ago. It's been used as an adjuvant for a long time. Are there newer studies, and does the FDA review on occasion licensure that was weighed in the past?
Well, let me answer it this way. I mean, that regulation was written some time ago. I mean, that data still holds up. And one thing we do have, given that, I mean, some of these studies were done in the 40s and 50s, but what we also have is experience. We have over 50 years of experience of vaccines containing aluminum salts, and these vaccines have been demonstrated to be safe. There are new studies. We have done an analysis, and we're still reviewing the data and the manuscript, but we will publish this, showing that the amount of aluminum in vaccines is lower than the minimum recommended, the minimum risk level set by the Agency for Toxic Substance and Disease Registry. So we are confident that the levels that are in vaccines are safe, and that these that which is in the regulations still holds up. We've actually gone through and looked at different scenarios of how much aluminum would you be exposed to if you had a certain number of vaccines, a certain schedule of vaccines, and then looked at again, the minimum risk levels, and we believe those are still within standards. So we think the amount that are used are safe. And we believe there, I mean, it's not just we think, and we believe there are data to support that.
Thanks.
Well,
thank you, Dr. Baylor. I've had the pleasure of hearing you speak several times lately, and it's always what you try to do with the risk-benefit discussion is difficult. Just getting that nice discussion was very helpful.
Thank you.
But having said that, my question is actually for John.
Thank you again.
So you get the compliment, he gets the question, you get the compliment too. I have something that I never have been able to quite understand ever since I first started hearing it, and that is given that VAERS is the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, why we are using the VAERS system to report administration errors, because it seems to me that's a misuse of what the system is supposed to be about, and you just showed that there were at least three other mechanisms for that reporting.
Right.
Thank you.
Right. So thank you. So I would certainly agree with you that VAERS was not designed as a medication error or patient safety reporting system. Of course, it was also not designed with the complexity of the current immunization schedule in mind. So I think if we keep in mind that the goal of reporting medication errors or vaccine administration errors to any system is to provide data that will enable us downstream to prevent administration errors, then I would say that if the decision is taken at an individual institution to report such administration errors, you can use any one of those reporting systems. If you further choose to report it to VAERS, we will strive to make the best use of that data to achieve the goal of preventing vaccine administration errors. And that's going to involve us working with you all and with our new partners in the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion, who do a lot of work in prevention and public health response to medication errors. So while it is true that it was not designed as a patient safety system, I think part of our role as the stewards of VAERS, you know, jointly with FDA, is to seek to make the best use of all the data that comes into the system.
Thanks. Hi, a question for Dr. Baylor. Doug Giugenti, I'm from Wyeth Vaccines Research. Other than aluminum, does CBER have standards set for other adjuvants in vaccines being developed, such as the oil and water emulsion, or for ISCOMs? Or?
Simple answer, no, we don't. But I mean, again, what we're looking at is, and I was not around in the days when they were looking at aluminum. That was a long time ago. And I really don't know what was the thinking, what was the thought process at that time. But I do know now that the new adjuvants that we're seeing, again, we're looking at those in the context of the whole product. I mean, there are a couple of adjuvants out there where they're used in a number of products, not just vaccines, but they're used therapeutically as well. And some of those products, what we have at the FDA is called a master file. And sometimes you can send for a review by the FDA certain products or certain compounds to the FDA to get a look at and to review in advance. And these other manufacturers and sponsors can reference this master file if they're using the same compound. So we have some of these novel adjuvants that come to us that way, and we've looked at them in isolation of the vaccine. But when you're bringing that vaccine to study in an IND or to license, you're bringing that adjuvant along with that product. And so we're looking at it in that way. And also, you're gonna submit data on proof of concept. You're going to give us a rationale as to the amount of adjuvant that you decided to use, and then you have to show us. So you may give us a dose ranging data, and then you'll demonstrate the whether that has actually provided an enhanced immune response. So we can look at it. We look at it on a product basis.
Dose ranging of the adjuvant, or?
You might even do a dose ranging of the adjuvant. I mean, I've recommended that to manufacturers. Why use more than you have to, especially when you think about the safety profile? If you can use the minimum amount to give you a nice, robust, enhanced immune response, it would make sense to do that. Hmm.
And if that's been established from preclinical trials with the dose ranging, would that still
You may do that with the preclinical. You may decide to do that in under IND as well.
Thank you.
Okay, one last question.
Dr. Baylor, I was just wondering, how does the FDA monitor and regulate vaccines that are manufactured outside of the United States?
That's a good question. Same way we do with in the U.S. And to give you a frank answer, but to give you a more detailed answer, it doesn't matter where the vaccine comes from or where the vaccine is manufactured. The rules are the same. They have whether the vaccine is manufactured in the United States or offshore, they have to follow the same regulations, the same rules, and meet the same standards as the vaccines here. So there's no dual standards. There's one standard, and that's the U.S. FDA standard.
Please join me in thanking both Dr. Istiger and Dr. Baylor for a great session.